This is KPDO 89.3 FM, serving Pescadero and the South Coast. This is Coastside Conversations, and my guest today is Louis Castoria. And we've had Louis here before as representing CLAM, the Coastal Literary Arts Movement, but now we're talking to him in relation to his day job. So, Louis, why don't you tell us what you want to talk about today?
Well, I am pretty happy to be going to the Supreme Court this year for the first time in my 40-year career. It's about a case, a First Amendment case, that has to do with the freedom people should have to support causes they deeply believe in a peaceful way, without fear of harassment or intimidation. That's it in a nutshell. And I'm a lawyer. I think most people who know, if anybody knows me at all, they probably think, oh, it's the guy with the eye patch in the newspaper who writes funny stuff sometimes.
So this is a First Amendment issue, obviously. This is free speech or something, am I right?
Speech and assembly, primarily. The right to free speech and to assemble peacefully to advocate for causes or things.
And how did this come about? I mean, can you give us a background or history on how you got to this point?
Yeah, it's I call it a long and winding road. No offense to the Beatles, but I filed the lawsuit in 2015. It's now 2021.
Wow.
And what happened was simply that the Attorney General of California was demanding that all nonprofits turn over their list of significant donors. It's an IRS form called Schedule B, but you don't have to remember that. It's just a list of donors. And Thomas More Law Center is my client. They received a demand, turn over the list or we will take away your license to do business in California and have activities in California. We'll sue your directors and officers and your tax preparer. I never really understood about the tax preparer. In addition to those things, we're going to essentially blacklist you from coming back to California. So it was not phrased quite that way, but those were the things that, also fines. There were going to be monetary fines. That's right.
That's a big deal. That sounds very threatening.
Yeah, well, I understand that the Attorney General's people were doing what their job told them they had to do to monitor the activity of nonprofits. But getting donor lists isn't really part of that and never has been.
We have always, I know I file 990s for a couple of different nonprofits, and we've always had to put on there a person if we had one who donated more than like $4,000 or $5,000 and put their name and address on there. Is this a similar idea?
Similar. Different nonprofits can do it in different ways. It could be a percentage. Mm. Anybody who donates more than X percent of the total donations, you have to give all the identifying information to or about, or the top 15 donors. There are a lot of different ways, but you can't get away with nobody.
Yeah.
And Thomas More has already said, we're not going to give away any of our donors' personal information. The exception is another part of the same form that asks about people who donate who are also in positions with the organization.
Sure.
Where there could be some risk of self-dealing.
Yeah, right.
And that's, nobody's questioning that.
Okay.
But in more than 10 years of having this regulation, California did just fine without requiring people to give the donor list. And then they changed their mind and started demanding it. But in all that time, there were only 5 cases where the Attorney General used the Schedule B donor list of any nonprofit, any of 60,000 nonprofits that list in California.
60,000?
60,000.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot.
But that probably includes, you know, nonprofits that aren't charities, right? Or are these charities?
Well, they're all charitable trusts.
Oh, wow.
So the only thing that they can't be is at all political.
I see.
These are 501c3 charities, to use the technical term.
No, I mean, everybody needs to know that because there are so many. And you want to know that your organization you're donating to is a 501c3 or it's not a tax-deductible donation.
Yeah. And you also can be outed as a donor. Especially true with political campaigns. But we're talking about good old-fashioned charitable trusts that do nonprofit good work.
Yeah.
And so in those five cases, the donor list was never looked at to initiate any of those cases. It was referred to, but the attorney general got most of the information either from the press, which cost nothing, or from a whistleblower in every one of those five cases.
So why do they need this? Is that the question?
That's right. Well, they don't.
Yeah.
Clearly, they don't need it because they didn't used to need it. California is one of only three states that has this requirement. The rest of the country, they want parts of the IRS 990 form. For identification of the organization purposes.
Right.
But they don't ask for the donor list.
Okay. And so amazingly, you brought this to the Supreme Court 6 years ago, I guess, and or five and a half, whatever.
Yeah, it's going on six.
Yeah.
But we started out in the trial court. Mm-hmm. I filed in the law in the U.S. District Court in Los Angeles. Central District.
Is that a loss? I mean, so that's California state law right there?
Well, it's California state law that the attorney general was enforcing, but we challenged the law in federal court because we alleged a violation of the federal constitution.
Okay.
And that's how it started.
Right. Okay. And so amazingly, it's gone up to different levels of court. So there must be a history to that. Why did it take six or five and a half years?
Well, nobody ever said litigation is quick. but this went from the district court, the trial court level, where we took it to trial. I was the trial counsel, and we won.
That's awesome.
So the federal district judge, who has since passed away, unfortunately, Not here to see that he's been vindicated, but he ruled in our favor and issued a permanent injunction against the attorney general, so to not enforce this demand for the donor lists. And the attorney general appealed it to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal. It went up actually in three stages, but eventually the Ninth Circuit ruled against the trial court and said, no, the attorney general can do this.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We then asked the entire Ninth Circuit panel. There's lots of judges on the Ninth Circuit. Mm-hmm. Only three of them hear an individual appeal. Mm-hmm. But then you can ask to have all the judges in the district hear the case as a group, or en banc, as they say, and good old legal Latinish.
And what was the swaying argument? Because one of the things that I picked up from looking at the history of this a little bit was that this first became a red flag when the NAACP said, we don't want to reveal our donors back in the day. I mean, before California ever got into demanding this, this had already been kind of settled, right?
Right.
And so the IRS isn't asking for this. The feds aren't asking for this. And so And it, you could see how the, it could jeopardize someone if, you know, especially, I mean, looking at right now, people, you know, are so polarized and so emotional about their beliefs, prejudices, biases, unconscious or otherwise. You don't want to expose people who might be supporting something that's a charity they, you know, some people don't believe in or don't like.
Yeah, right? It's dangerous times we live in.
It is. And Let's look at it.
The same kind of times in a different way from that NAACP case in the mid-1950s,
yeah,
where it was the Attorney General of Alabama saying, give me your membership list. It wasn't it for donors, it was for members.
Wow.
And the only way to put this is flatly, if that list had been given out, there would have been lynchings.
Yeah.
Everybody knew it.
Of course.
And
that was a time of lynching, you know? And,
yeah.
And you know, did the lynchings ever totally stop? I mean, yeah. So I get it in that context, and that's what makes it real to me, that, okay, I can see how this could present a danger to some people in some circumstances. So if you have to protect some charities, why make it a rule? You know, just don't do it,
yeah,
right? Under what circumstances? I mean, I suspect if there were racketeering, you know, if people thought money laundering was going on or something, but that's a totally different thing. That's when you start auditing or investigating, right?
That's right. And that, and there are different parts of the tax return document that deal with those kinds of issues,
mm-hmm,
without getting into show me all your donors.
Right.
The big issue, I won't say this is why the Supreme Court granted a hearing to us, but it has to be part of the reason, is because there's a split between the appellate courts in the country. The Ninth Circuit, where we are, has watered down the standard that the government has to prove in order to enforce a regulation or law that takes away people's free speech rights. The NAACP case called it strict scrutiny, which means it has to be directly related to an important government project or purpose. It has to be narrowly tailored, so it only gets as much information as they need. And it has to be the least restrictive means.
So
those
three
things. But the Ninth Circuit,
yeah,
only has watered it down to simply, is there a reason why the government wants this?
Oh, wow.
Is it somewhat related to one of its functions?
Isn't that odd that that California, I mean, the Ninth Circuit covers California, Nevada, some Western states, correct?
Oregon, Washington.
Yeah, I mean, these are states that are very staunchly free speech, very staunchly First Amendment adherents and advocates. So why would the Ninth Circuit come out with this, oh, we don't care that much about violating your free speech rights? What's that about?
I wouldn't characterize it quite that way, but this
okay,
happened over time, though. And Catherine, one of the things that does happen in the law is that there's drift.
Mm-hmm.
When NAACP was decided, everybody in the country, at least who followed legal proceedings, heard about this in the news and read about it, and it was clear that you got to meet a very, very high standard as the government to take away people's free association and free speech rights. But over time, things get chipped away a little bit and exceptions get made until there comes a point where it doesn't really resemble the original standard that was set. And that's what happened here. I don't think it was a big philosophical thing or mean intention, but it was drift, and it's causing just as bad a harm as if it was intentional and
right,
malicious.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine yourself, or imagine your listeners thinking, why? Imagine also, by the way, that you're not in California. Let's say you're in Ohio,
mm-hmm,
and you give money to a charity in Ohio that also does business in California. Mm-hmm. Are you going to think twice before you donate money to that charity, thinking the California Attorney General wants my address?
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, why yes. should I give my address, phone number, and everything else to the a state where I've never been to California even.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, so it's odd that they did this, but what you're saying is you don't think it was bad intentions. It was just, hey, let's see what we can get, right?
Yeah.
Let's get some more information.
Well, I think the proof of that is they created this humongous database to hold the annual donor lists for all 60,000 charities that operate in California. And they have a big computer system for it, and it leaks like a sieve. We found in the course of the case that thousands of donor lists, not individual donors, but lists of donors, were placed on a publicly available part of the Attorney General's website.
Oh, my God.
We also found that a forensic scientist came in and helped us to show that it was very susceptible to hacking, and that there's a big risk of hacking in this area for two reasons. One is economic. Lots of other charities want to know other charities' donor lists so that they can spam them and try to get donations themselves.
Right.
But more in a more sinister way, there are lots of people who do not enjoy others exercising their right of free speech and want to silence them. Now, can I give you a couple of quick examples?
I would love that. Okay. I mean, we need that so we know, you know, to make it real.
I'll bring it home to real people. So Thomas More has kept its donor list quiet all this time and has faced the risk of being delisted and fined and all other things. But the people they can't protect are the people who they represent in court. You can't just say John Doe is the plaintiff all the time if the person's going to have to testify. So some of the people who Thomas More has represented in court because the government has tried to punish them for exercising their free speech rights have had some really awful consequences. One woman in New York City who the Thomas More Law Center represented her in a case, she had two death attempts, not just threats. There were two attempts on her life, assassins sent in by Islamic terrorist groups domestically.
Oh, wow.
Both were foiled.
Thank God.
But that happened to her. And she's been threatened many, many, many times more.
Wow.
A U.S. Marine who served in the Gulf War after coming home has a daughter who, at the time of the case in 2015, was in high school, so she must be out of college by now.
Mm-hmm.
But in a public school in their state, not California, a teacher assigned the student to write a book report about parts of the Quran. Now, you know, if anybody had done the same thing, saying at a public school, write a book report about parts of the Bible,
mm-hmm.
That teacher would be on suspension the next moment.
Mm-hmm.
But they actually gave the student an F in the class for failing to write a report about the Quran. And the Marine, the father, with the help of Thomas More Law Center, brought a case to fix her grade system the way it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
They got threats from people, anonymous people, saying they were going to kidnap, rape, and murder the daughter because the Marine had the temerity to challenge the school district's ruling that she should have to write about the Quran.
Oh, my God.
So this is real. I mean, these are extreme cases, I'll admit.
Uh-huh.
But they're real.
I guess I need to ask more about Thomas More. So in general, I mean, without obviously naming names, what kind of cases do you bring? Are you, in other words, does the law firm specialize in freedom of speech cases? Is that what they focus on?
Yes, it is not specifically a religious institution. It is a private law firm, but it was founded to advance ideals of traditional Catholic doctrine. Mm-hmm. So if someone peacefully challenges the right to abortion and is punished for saying that, Thomas More Law Center would defend that person.
I see.
Yes, it is free speech. It's all based on deeply held religious beliefs, primarily from Catholic dogma. Mm. But you know, there are other organizations that advocate the opposite.
Sure, the principles apply to any set of beliefs, yeah. Right?
And that's important. Mm-hmm. It was to me the day I got the case. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, as a lawyer, I don't have to agree with every position my client takes.
Of course not.
But I have to be able to say, I can support that client regardless of what I agree or disagree with. That's irrelevant.
Right. And then
if you don't believe in the First Amendment being for everyone, then you don't believe in the First Amendment.
Right. Exactly. And I that's kind of what the ACLU is all about as well.
Sure.
Right. So I have a question to apply that. Right. And by the way, if you don't mind, can you name your law firm? I don't think we've asked you that question yet.
No, you haven't. No. I have to get a plug in somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm a lawyer and I've worked in San Francisco for 40 years for two different law firms. The one I'm with now is called Kaufman, Dolowich, and Volokh. And I'm not going to spell it for you. I know it sounds like three Star Wars villains, but they've been around.
But KVD, it goes by KVD.
KDV.
Sure.
KDV. And it's a national firm, just under 200 lawyers, mm-hmm. 10 offices. And we are all a civil practice firm. We don't do criminal mm-hmm. law. Mm-hmm. And this is a civil case, the Thomas More case.
Sure.
So, thank you for the opportunity to say that. I would say that our office locally is in San Francisco, which is true, except nobody's there right now.
Which is so true. I mean, suddenly we have distributed offices, right?
You sure do.
It's the work from home way to go. This your law firm took this on, but it is defending another law firm, in a sense.
Yes.
Am I right? Yeah.
We're defending Thomas More Law Center.
Okay. And Thomas More Law Center is an advocate for free speech, but very specifically in regard to Catholic dogma.
That's right.
But you guys are just a civil case attorney firm.
Right.
And it could be freedom of speech or a number of things.
Right.
Right.
Most of our work is... And it's not mine personally, but most of the work in the firm is employment practices, cases. I'm on the group that primarily does professional liability, which is along the lines of defending another law firm, which
sure.
is what I'm doing.
Sure.
And I still defend a lot of other law firms and malpractice cases and such. And then there's a variety of other practice areas, construction, things like that.
Can I try to make it a little bit relevant in terms of this? I hope you don't mind my bringing it up. The FCC likes us to talk about controversial issues to educate the public. And so I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about the situation that happened in Washington, D.C. And just from the standpoint that the ACLU actually came out in terms of our tech companies like Facebook and Twitter and other social media, banning permanently President Trump from, you know, ever communicating on their platforms again. And I wonder if you've, you know, obviously nobody should be able to incite insurrection. That's an incident that no one has a question about. But the question becomes, in our country, do we allow the tech firms to decide these things? And is that a matter of freedom of speech? Is that a matter of monopoly? How would you look at that?
I have to say, as a preface, I'm not speaking for Thomas More Law Center now.
Okay.
You've asked me what my opinion is, and yeah. I'll tell you, I don't mind telling you my opinion, but sure. This has nothing really, does not reflect on Thomas More Law Center at all.
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I see there's a real tension here. Mm-hmm. These are private companies.
Right.
I mean, they're publicly traded.
But they're not government entities.
They're not government entities.
Or even government regulated, really.
Yeah. And they have a right to control their message mm-hmm. and their messaging to the public. Mm-hmm. And if they decide, as certainly Twitter did, that they don't want their platform used to let people work together toward violence.
Sure.
Collaborate mm-hmm. toward violence, that makes perfect sense to me.
Of course.
Now, there is a countervailing thing in my head, which is we call them social media. Mm-hmm. And traditional media are regulated. I mean, KPTO is regulated by the FCC.
Correct.
And there's a question about whether, the extent to which, social media ought to be regulated in terms of content and such. I have a problem with that.
Well, in terms of content, I'm not asking that question because I don't think anybody agrees with that idea, I hope. I'm asking the question, does a non-government entity have the right, and maybe because they're a private firm they do, but do they have the right to kick somebody off permanently? It's like a life sentence. And I get stopping messages that incite riots or violence or groups that incite violence. But does that apply to social media? That's sort of the question I have.
And I have the same question.
Oh, you do?
I have the same question. Mm. Like I say, I'm kind of two minds about it. Mm-hmm. I'm eager to see how it works out. Mm-hmm. But if you think about cases like people don't know law case names very much, but everybody's heard about the Hobby Lobby case.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So
I would say so, but you might just give us a thumbnail,
okay.
Right?
So Hobby Lobby has a chain of hobby stores around the country, does very well. So Hobby Lobby had an ethical problem about including birth control in their company's health care plan.
Right, I remember.
And that went up mm-hmm. to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, and I'm going to oversimplify it, that companies and owners of companies are allowed to make those kinds of decisions for themselves on ethical or religious grounds. So there's that. Now, Twitter is not notably a religious organization, but they've got their considerations of ethics.
Absolutely.
And they don't have to do business with anyone they don't want to do business with. So that I think that's where I'm coming out on it is.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if
the problem with that is that they are a monopoly. In other words, if you want to get the word out, the ways that you do it these days, at least for a lot of people, are Facebook, Twitter, you know, things like that,
yeah.
Right? Instagram and whatever. So if a company shuts you down and you're a person who makes their living by being famous, that's a death knell, you know? That's a difficult hurdle to overcome. What are your options? And so, you know, maybe I'm overstating it. And hey, I have no sympathy whatsoever with the person that they booted off their platform. But it just has repercussions for the rest of us. That's what I'm thinking about. Is this a precedent that can come back to haunt us?
Possibly. In this instance, though, Mr. Trump could pick up the phone and call Fox News and be in the studio in 20 minutes.
That's
and
true.
He could talk the whole day on Fox News.
You know, you're right. He's got many platforms. Yeah. So what are we talking about here?
For him, I'm not too concerned.
Yeah.
for somebody else, if they started doing it categorically, if they didn't like the Thomas More Law Center and said, we're not going to allow people who express Catholic faith-based opinions, I'd have a problem
That'd
with that.
That'd be a big problem.
Yeah. Anyway, it does kind of tie back into our case in that everyone should have the right, free from government control, to peacefully advocate for the things they deeply believe in.
Of course.
And that's it.
I think most people do agree with that. And so you feel like violence is the cutoff right there.
Yeah.
An individual or a company starts advocating violence and nobody should question a social media platform decision to boot them off.
Yeah. And a good example might be that Marine Corps fellow who didn't want his daughter to write something about the Quran in a public school.
Sure.
So that was his opinion. His daughter was still a minor. Mm-hmm. She also agreed with him, but they said, we're not going to do this on religious grounds. That's totally peaceful. Going to court to advocate as to why she shouldn't have to is totally peaceful.
Sure.
And the division line is saying, I'm going to kidnap your daughter, rape and kill her. That's speech. But there's no question that if that person had been identified, he should be prosecuted for it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, well, this is fascinating. This is an interesting discussion, and I really thank you for bringing it to us because it brings up topics we really have to think about, right? And so congratulations on getting to the point where this is now before the Supreme Court, and when will it actually be heard, do we know?
Not a definite date. We know an estimate of sometime in April, and of course the big question to me is, do I get to go in person? Or do I go watch it on Zoom? I sure hope I get to go.
Yeah, let's just, maybe it'll get extended and everybody will get vaccinated. You know, Andrew Yang had a really interesting idea I just heard yesterday. He said everybody should have a little app on their phone. And if they've gotten vaccinated, they should be allowed to go to a restaurant or a movie or whatever. You know, they can just show that, hey, I've finished my vaccination injections and I'm good to go, right?
Right.
Because that would be such an incentive for people. And then we'd get people, and I get to get vaccinated next Wednesday.
Oh, good for you.
I'm so excited about that. Well, because I'm so old, right?
I made the same suggestion in my humor column, which sometimes I write semi-serious, a suggestion that there be a COVID ID card.
Yeah.
And somebody else had already come up with the idea of the phone app.
Sure.
So that's the route we're going to be going, is you get a clearance that you just show on your phone app, and it will allow you to do some of the things we can't do right now.
Exactly. And we don't know when there's going to be herd immunity, so why not have an app? Because think of all the people who don't want to get vaccinated. Well, we don't want to be contaminated by those people or whatever. And so why not, give people an incentive, right, to get vaccinated? And there's no violation of any kind of rights for that. You are protecting the public health. And then you're giving people a reward for actually participating in a process that protects the public health. I think that's a really good thing. And so then, we can start opening up sooner. Businesses can open up sooner, knowing that their employees are people who have gone through the process. I think it's a great idea. Why not?
Yeah. Well, I really miss San Francisco for a lot of reasons. One of them is the restaurants.
Absolutely.
And
I mean, think of Duarte's. Think of the Taqueria.
Yep.
Think of all the places around here that, you know, they're going to go out of business if we don't have some way of accelerating the process of them opening up Highway 1 Brewing down the road. They desperately need a boost, and this would help tremendously if people, as soon as they were vaccinated, could go out and be a part of the economic, our commerce.
Yeah, and if we don't do that, all those businesses and business owners will be out of business.
That's it.
But somebody else is going to come in and fill that gap, and that's the unfairness to me.
It is.
That
the people who
built these businesses and established these restaurants and all will be out of luck, and some opportunist will come in and swoop it up and say, well,
and build on what they've already, what the foundation that they left behind.
Yeah.
I know, it's not fair. It's just not fair. And so I'm hoping that we do things like that to really accelerate the process of getting our economy going. Listen, I see you looking at your watch. I really do appreciate your time. I think it's a very interesting case, and I'm proud that somebody who's, you know, local, Coastside person, is involved with it. So that's great.
Thank you.
News. So again, my guest today is Louis Castoria, and his firm we're going to call KDV, right?
KDV.
KDV.
And KDVlaw.com.
Okay, KDVlaw.com. And this is a very interesting free speech case. And we had a little discussion about all the issues on free speech that are relevant for the moment. So thank you so much, Louis.
Oh, my real pleasure.
Good. Thank you so much. Okay.